$2 billion a year in tax relief to the industry is a gigantic figure. We will not be bullied into making a $2 billion mistake.
A rare floor speech in the state Senate. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 11th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Board of Game passes a new restriction on hunting in the state.
You cannot use a taser to incapacitate a big game animal except in defense of life or property.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Association of Alaska School Boards. AASB believes that all students should be proficient in reading, writing, and math by the time they finish the third grade. More information at aasb.org.
And by
AT&T, Rethink Possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The Senate leadership today hardened its opposition to Governor Sean Parnell's tax reduction for the oil industry. In a speech from the floor of the Senate, President Gary Stevens called for caution in moving the bill along, warning his fellow members to be suspicious of those who promote fear that the Trans-Alaska Pipeline will be closed if the legislature doesn't pass the tax break. Stevens said the legislature needs information, data, and cooperation from the administration and industry before deciding whether to cut taxes. He reminded supporters of the tax bill that rushing to a conclusion will not work. Stevens also pointed out production estimates in legal proceedings last year show the pipeline to be still operational until 2047 and will be viable with only a third of the production it now carries. Stevens says the TAPS line will not close. In fact, if it were not there, it would be built now.
The governor's bill has a long way to go in the time we have left. The real problem, in my estimation, is that we have not been given adequate information and answers from the administration, from the Department of Labor. There appears to be a lot of skepticism about whether the tax reductions will really trigger new oil production into the pipeline. I think we all agree that we would like to see more oil in the pipeline, but the governor's bill, as it now reads, giving $2 billion in tax relief to oil companies without firm guarantees to Alaskans that they will look for more oil or that they will hire more Alaskans, is an issue.
The governor's response came in an email from Press Secretary Sharon Lehow, who pointed to statements made by ConocoPhillips CEO Jim Mulva last week that the company has $5 billion in projects ready to go if the tax regime were changed. Stevens asked in his speech why Mulva, through his employees and lobbyists, had not made the same commitment before the legislature during House hearings. Lehow said the Senate cannot dispute that oil production is down and that affects Alaska's economy. The legislature at last has a capital projects budget to look at. The Senate Finance Committee released its own version of the plan this afternoon. Committee co-chair Bert Stedman described a substitute for the governor's bill that was introduced at the start of the session. He compared the plan to last year's capital budget, which would have spent $3 billion when it passed, and ended up spending $2.75 billion after the governor vetoed parts of it. He said the current budget spends $2.9 billion and it saves money too.
Also in this proposed budget is another $500 million going to savings. So that would put our savings component, and we've got another vehicle that has $1 billion in it and $400 million for PCE. There's $500 in here, so it would be $1.9 billion. We're saving at this table roughly $2 for every dollar we're spending in capital appropriations. Just to give you an idea of the magnitude, a couple of years ago we were concentrating on saving a dollar and spending a dollar. This year it's 2-for-1.
The committee will begin hearing details of the new bill tomorrow. The State House on Saturday passed a bill that loosens the state's self-defense laws. The measure, by Big Lake Republican Mark Newman, says deadly force is allowed by a person who feels unsafe or threatened if he is any place he or she has a right to be. Newman said there has been a lot of misconception about the changes he wants.
People think that if we have the ability to protect yourself, or you have a right to be, that people are going to automatically go out and start committing murders. Nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing. The rights that you have as an Alaskan while you're in your home or place of business should follow you where you have a right to be. That's all this says. It does not change the justification part in statute.
Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra, an attorney, argued that what Newman wants is already covered under state law.
This bill is not about protecting yourself or protecting others. If they need your protection, you can use your gun and you can shoot them. That's the current law. This bill now says that in public places, if you're at a mall, if you're completely safe and everybody else is completely safe, you can still shoot somebody.
The Senate still has to pass the bill if it is to become law. In the wake of new restrictions for the commercial salmon fishery in Upper Cook Inlet, one organization is preparing to fight back against the Alaska Board of Fisheries with a lawsuit if necessary. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has the details.
In a meeting held Tuesday night way out the end of Homer's East End Road in the Russian Old Believer village of Voznesenka, a group of about 30 or so members of the Upper Cook Inlet Drift Association, or UCIDA, gathered together to strategize about how to fight back from new Board of Fisheries restrictions that are set to go into effect for the upcoming salmon seasons.
This is a pretty different kind of board of fish. And they did some things that we've not seen a board of fish do before anywhere in the state of Alaska.
That's UCIDA Executive Director Roland Ma, who did most of the talking at the meeting. The dozens of changes made last month by the Board of Fisheries affecting the Cook Inlet drift fleet are many, and if you're not a commercial salmon fisherman, the whole matter can get pretty complicated. UCIDA members are particularly concerned about rule changes that would remove a large fishing area south of Kalgan Island, create a fixed window for the set net fishery instead of a floating window, and change the so-called 1% rule that could spell an early end to the commercial salmon season. UCIDA board member Dave Martin says the changes could cost Upper Cook Inlet drift fishermen as much as 40% of their catch. Ma says that the way things shook out at the Board of Fish meeting has created confusion among staff members of the Department of Fish and Game and the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, or COMFISH.
Because what was happening, you would have two or three board members who would talk to a staff member and say, we intend for this to happen. And while that discussion was going on, there'd be a couple of more board members talking to another staff person from Fish and Game saying, this is really what we intend. And then you got the chairman talking to the director of COMFISH saying, this is really what I want. You getting a feel for this Board of Fish?
Ma describes a three-way interagency fight between Fish and Game, COMFISH, and the State Department of Law.
I'm hearing bits and pieces out of Juneau. I'm hearing bits and pieces out of COMFISH and SportFish. All I know is that they're mad.
And that's about the point in the meeting where Ma and the UCIDA board asked not to be recorded anymore.
Decided to do. And at this point, I'm going to have to ask the mic to go off.
KBBI News granted Ma and the UCIDA board's request to temporarily turn our microphone off, with the understanding that their plans, if not their exact legal strategy, can be made public. Ma says UCIDA is preparing to sue the state of Alaska over the Board of Fisheries decisions at their March meeting. Before that happens, however, a letter will be drafted by the organization pointing out alleged irregularities in the Fish Board's decision-making process, including that certain documents justifying the Fish Board's actions may have been created after the meeting. That letter will be sent to Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell and members of the Alaska State Legislature, with the request that an investigation of the Fish Board meeting be conducted and all Fish Board decisions made at that meeting be suspended until the investigation is complete. If their requests are not granted, Ma promises UCIDA will bring its case to court. The organization has spent in the neighborhood of $300,000 on litigation just in the last 3 years, says Ma, including an unrelated legal fight with the state over regulation of the personal use dip net fishery. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
The state has made it illegal to use tasers on wildlife in most circumstances, including hunting. The proposal approved by the Game Board late last month was put forward by Larry Lewis, a Department of Fish and Game biologist in Soldotna. Lewis says the regulation is straightforward.
You cannot use a taser to incapacitate a big game animal except in defense of life or property.
Lewis says he forwarded the proposal to stop the potential misuse of tasers because the devices have become more commonplace. He says tasers do have a role in wildlife management. Lewis and a state trooper successfully used one to control an angry mother moose while they freed her calves from a foundation hole. Lewis says tasers pose less risk to animals than sedation, but he still doesn't recommend people carry them as a defense against large animals.
My general advice to people is no, do not use it to defend yourself against a moose or a bear. We're still researching, we're still developing, and I say that the best thing to use is whatever a person's feels competent and practiced with in a potentially life-threatening situation. If it happens to be the civilian use taser that you use and you decide to use that to defend your life or those around you, then that's fine. But I wouldn't recommend it as a first choice.
Lewis says most tasers require you to be within 35 feet of the target, and you have to get the probes to stick into the animal to shock it. Department of Fish and Game staff and others trained and permitted by the state will be able to use tasers for wildlife management. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new top-secret reality TV show being filmed in Sitka.
We've been in different cafes around town with a camera crew, and we can't really discuss any other details.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The Sitka Sound Sacro Herring Fishery wrapped up over the weekend with an opening Saturday that pulled in 3,200 tons of the small silver fish. The opening started at 4:10 p.m. and lasted 2 hours and 45 minutes. It was the fifth opening of the season. Preliminary numbers from all five openings show a total harvest of 19,636 tons. That's about 150 tons over this year's guideline harvest limit. Dave Gordon is the area management biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
From a management perspective, you can't get any much more precise than this, really. I mean, it's just a couple percentages off the guideline harvest level, and for this type of fishery, I feel very good about where it came out, and a couple hundred tons above the guideline harvest level, and all it takes is one set to change that in a hurry, so I think it came out very well.
Sitka's herring fishery has long been the focus of documentaries and nature TV specials. Now the fishery is slated to be the subject of a TV reality show. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
Try for a second to make a short list of the reality TV shows set in Alaska. You're going to come up with shows about gold, state troopers, crabbing, ice road trucking, bush pilots, logging. You're going to be making a long list. And Brett Verhuizen, one of the subjects of a new reality show to be set in Alaska, says he is well aware of that.
You can say that the market is saturated with Alaska TV shows, but the footage that they've received in the past 9 days will blow everybody out of the water.
Verhuizen, 25, and Sierra Anderson, also 25, are the subjects of a reality TV show on commercial fishing in Alaska, which includes the Sitka Sacro herring fishery. Crews were here during the openings to film the pair as they crewed aboard the Memory Ann, a Chignik-registered seine boat. Now, because of contracts they've signed for the show, they can't talk about the name of the show or who's producing it or when it will air because...
We would get sued.
But they've tweeted about it on Twitter, so we know there is a show. And, of course, they've been seen around town with a big video crew and a microphone, which they've named
Sparky.
Sound
and so
man.
We've been in Murray Pacific, and we've been in the P-Bar different cafes around town with a camera crew, and we can't really discuss any other details. But
they can tell me their story. Verhusen and Anderson were childhood friends in Chignik. The boat we're on now, the Memory Anne, was once the Shady Lady. Verhusen spent summers aboard this boat when his family owned it, and now the boat is owned by Anderson's family. Here's Sierra Anderson.
I ended up going herring fishing for the first time last season, and then it was just a chain of events from bad to worse, it seemed like. And
last year, during the herring fishery, the Shady Lady was pictured on the front page of the Sitka Sentinel, tipped over on its side and leaning against a tender boat. It was repaired in Seattle and renamed the Memory Anne.
And that's where I ran into Brett for the first time in since we were 15, yeah, basically.
So Verhusen and Anderson both have similar backgrounds. They went away to college, they got degrees in business, and Verhusen got a job working for a hedge fund in Seattle.
Everything was glass, and I had flat screen monitors, and I sat on a $700 chair, and I mean, you know, you had unlimited supply of snacks and refreshments in the break room, and I was so bored out of my mind, I couldn't even begin to explain. Not only that, but I probably entered at the worst possible time.
He began his hedge fund job in July of 2008, and in September, Lehman Brothers collapsed, taking a good chunk of the economy with it. So now, Verhusen runs a salmon boat in Bristol Bay, and Anderson continues to crew aboard fishing boats, including the Memory Anne, where she pilots the Seine skiff.
It's kind of in our blood, and this is, like, not normal for us, but at the same time, it kind of is. This is what we know, this is what we grew up with. And for me, it's an epic adventure. It's, like, exciting. It's an adrenaline rush. It's a challenge. For me, is running that skiff out there and that rodeo is the biggest challenge I've ever had in the skiff.
And now they're using their careers as fuel for a blog about life in Alaska and in commercial fishing. You can follow their further adventures online at therealalaska.com. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
For the first time in 35 years, the State Department of Fish and Game today opened a commercial herring sacro fishery in West Beam Canal near Ketchikan. The commercial gillnet fishery opened at 10:30 a.m., but as of this afternoon, no boats were fishing. KRBD's Deanna Garrison has this story.
Speaking from the research vessel Medea on Monday morning, Fish and Game Commercial Fisheries Management Biologist Scott Walker says the spawn began in earnest on Sunday. He says about 7 to 8 miles of herring spawn has been observed so far in West Beam Canal.
It's looking very fishy. There's fish all throughout Clover Pass, around Benton Island, Valner Bay, and even all on the backside of Gravina Island. So it looks very fishy.
Walker says Fish and Game has been conducting daily sonar and aerial surveys of the area in the lead up to the commercial fishery.
Most of our expectations have been reached, and so we feel like today is the day to get the fishery going.
Fish and Game estimated nearly 12,000 tons of herring to return to the West Beam area this spring. Of that, gillnetters would be allowed to harvest 1,276 tons. Walker says it's unclear just how many commercial boats will ultimately participate in the fishery this year. At most, he figures 20 to 25 gillnetters will fish, but he says he wouldn't be surprised if no one fished.
The market is very unstable right now with the other fisheries that have gone on and with the situation in Japan, which is one of our major buyers, and West Beam has been fairly small fish. So right now, we have only a handful that we've been talking to. Everybody is going to wait, it looks like, until the buyer kind of gives the go-ahead, as in the fish are going to be the right size for the market.
The West Beam Canal sacro herring fishery has been the source of an ongoing public debate in Ketchikan. Detractors of the fishery cite sustainability concerns due to the unpredictability of stocks over the last 30 years. Supporters say once depleted, herring stocks have rebounded and therefore should be available for commercial harvest. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
The mail is again flowing to the island community of Adak after an apparent dispute between Alaska Airlines and the Transportation Security Administration caused the airline to suspend carrying larger parcels on its passenger flights. In most cases, parcels have been rerouted on other airlines, but Adak's only scheduled connection is a twice-weekly Alaska Airlines flight that is subsidized by the federal government. People in Adak were informed April 1st that priority parcels greater than 16 ounces could no longer be delivered. This was a concern, as prescription medication is often shipped priority and alternatives are more expensive. U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich intervened last week. Murkowski said that Alaska Airlines has been out of compliance with a new TSA requirement.
Alaska Airlines has been out of compliance since August, when a cargo screening requirement issued by the TSA went into place. It required 100% of cargo to be screened, and apparently an audit was conducted, and it was determined that there has been this lack of compliance.
Both senators say they have been given assurances that a temporary waiver for ADAC has been issued. The state is looking at whether additional measures are needed to keep dust out of the air. The fine particulate matter is typically blown up from road surfaces during dry, windy weather, but that there are also issues with sandblasting, material transport, and storage. Department of Environmental Conservation Permit Manager Tom Turner says dust is becoming a bigger issue as the state's urbanized areas grow.
Increased population, and so those populations are closer to industrial areas, and you have an increased amount of resource extraction, which is a type of material that could create fugitive dust.
Coal ash is of special concern because it contains toxic heavy metals scrubbed from power plant emissions. The ash is considered inert and not a threat to leach into water and soil, but many tons of it are produced daily at Fairbanks area power plants. Friday, the ANCSA at 40 committee hosted a panel discussion on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, or ANCSA. They described the far-reaching effects of the law and how it didn't live up to everyone's expectations. KNBA's Jocelyn Estes has more.
Panelist Jack Roderick worked in oil exploration, served as mayor of Anchorage from 1972 through 1975, and as deputy commissioner of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. He's the author of Crude Dreams, a personal history of oil and politics in Alaska. He says the knowledge and experience of Southeast Alaska Natives were critical to leaders in the movement that led to ANCSA.
A lot of history in Southeast by William Paul and his son and three lawyers. But William Paul was a key guy. He educated Charlie Edwardson. You know, don't give up. And I think Don Wright was a student of his. You know, it's our land. It's all our land.
North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta has held leadership positions in the Barrow Whaling Captains Association and the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. Itta says North Slope leaders knew they owned valuable lands.
The leases had been sold 400,000 acres to the oil industry for $900 million without anybody asking us or telling us how do you do. So, in the sense of use and occupancy, our leaders had a very, very strong belief and conviction that this is ours. The U.S. Constitution says so.
Panelist Mike Gravel was a U.S. Senator for Alaska for two terms from 1969 to 1981 and a presidential candidate in 2008. Gravel says ANCSA came about because of the efforts of many people, events, and forces, but he says perhaps the two most important were unity among Alaska Natives and the ability of Scoop Jackson, Democratic Senator from Washington, to move legislation through Congress.
I view the success of that, the Natives themselves, because the rest of us were on the chessboard playing our roles, and some of us played them pretty well. But it was those two elements, a leader in the Congress who could meld together the power of the Congress to whatever was arrived at in subcommittee was going to pass into law.
Since the 1960s, panelist and longtime journalist Tim Bradner has covered the Native Claims Movement and the oil industry. Bradner says ANCSA profoundly changed Alaska's economy. For instance, he says it led to the adoption of the Alaska National Interest Lands Act, or ANILCA, and opened the door to oil development.
Part of that was the provision of Section 17D2 in the Land Claims Act set lands aside for study for national parks and wildlife refuges. That led eventually to ANILCA in 1980. But along the way, to get the pipeline, the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company had to get secure title across lands. And to do that, they had to settle the land claims.
ANCSA put title to 44 million acres in private ownership through newly formed Native corporations. However, ITTA says Arctic Slope leaders argued for 56.5 million acres just for the Inupiaq of the North Slope.
To this day, our region continues to feel that we were shortchanged by a big, big amount. And while we don't dwell on it, we still say something that was inherently ours was given away.
The panel was organized by an ad hoc committee called ANCSA at 40, which plans to host more panels in coming months. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Aaron Selbig in Homer, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. One answer to our state's declining oil production? Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.